Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Friday, March 11th, 2024. Let the record reflect the time is 3:20 p.m. Today we have present Representative Sadler, Representative Prox, Representative Wright, Representative Carrick, Representative Fields, Vice Chair Ruffridge, myself, Chair Sumner. The staff that will be assisting us today are Kevin Allen with House Records, Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, and Clark Bickford, my staff and committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. We have four items on the agenda today, starting with the first hearing of HB 189, sale of alcohol by persons under 21, a bill from the House Labor and Commerce Committee. I'd like to call my staff, Serena Hackenmiller, to please approach the committee, put your name on the record. And we need to adopt a new version of the bill. Vice Chair Ruffridge, do you have a motion?
Yes, thank you, Chair Sumner. I move to adopt committee substitute for House Bill number, is that Senate Bill?
No, House Bill.
This one here.
This is
wrong.
H.
HB, yeah. I would move to adopt committee substitute for HB 189 version S, also referred to as 33-LS0697-S.
And I'll object for discussion. Mrs. Hackenmiller, can you proceed with your sponsor statement and explanation of changes?
Certainly. Good afternoon. My name is Serena Hackenmiller. I'm staff to Chair Sumner. I'd like to go over the sponsor statement first for HB 189. HB 189 would aim to change existing Alaska statutes that would allow employees between the ages of 18 and 20 to serve, sell, dispense, and deliver alcohol within restaurant establishments under appropriate supervision. HB 189 would create positive change in the following ways. Labor shortages. Restaurants, particularly in smaller communities, face a significant labor shortage. Allowing individuals aged 18 to 20 to serve alcohol would expand the available workforce, helping alleviate staffing problems and benefiting the overall industry. Economic growth. The restaurant industry is a significant driver of economic activity in Alaska. Expanding the potential workforce strengthens businesses, allowing them to operate at full capacity, leading to greater economic contributions overall. Responsible service. Many establishments already implement robust training programs to ensure responsible alcohol service practices. These measures, combined with on-site supervision, could effectively ensure responsible service by young adults within the restaurant setting. We firmly believe that with adequate training and supervision, employees aged 18 to 20 can responsibly and safely handle alcohol sales and service in a controlled restaurant environment. I'd like to add that Alaska is one of three states that requires servers to be 21 and over, and 46% of states allow servers to be 18. This change would benefit Alaska's economy, alleviate labor shortages, and promote fairness within our service industry. And with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to go over the explanation of changes. Okay. In this version, there's only a few small changes to Section 1. It specifies that the person under 21 must be employed. Section 2 is no change. Section 3 is a new section which modifies the theater license statutes. Section 4 is the prior Section 3. This specifies that the person under 21 must be employed. Section 5 is prior Section 4. Section 6 is prior Section 5. It specifies that the person under 21 must be employed. Section 7 is prior Section 6. Section 8 is prior Section 7. Section 9 is a new section. It updates and modifies AS 0409, 049H. Section 10 is prior Section 8. Section 11 is a new section. It repeals 0409250D, which is related to theater license. Section 12 is prior Section 9, but it also updates the effective date to January 1st, 2025.
Okay, and I'll remove my objection to adopting the CS. Is there any other objection?
Object for discussion.
Okay, Representative Carrick.
Thank you to the chair or to your staff. Section 3 says modifies theater license statutes. Can you just briefly describe what the modifications are in Section 3?
Certainly, through the chair to Representative Carrick. So this expands the time period in which a theater license may sell and distribute alcohol, sell or serve alcoholic beverages, and it removes the intermission language.
Thank you. I found it. I remove my objection.
Do you object, Representative Sadler?
I guess for purpose of discussion, yes, okay. I do. I will object. And through the chair to your staff here. So theater license, just want to make sure that I have had occasion occasionally to go to the Beartooth Theater. I don't drink myself, but I go with people that do sometimes. Is that what the theater license is? Is that a movie theater, or is that like the PAC that sells wine intermission? What is a theater license?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, that's a good question. I can tell you that the PAC is a theater license. I do not know if Beartooth is only a theater license, but they also, because they are also a restaurant licensee, they would have to respond to that.
Okay. And if I had the opportunity to ask the question later, I'll reserve that, but I will remove my objection for discussion.
Okay, so without objection, we have adopted the committee substitute. We will go on to invited testimony. David McCarthy, owner and CEO of 49th State Brewing. If you could please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, my name is David McCarthy, McCarthy. I am the CEO of Northern Hospitality Group. We operate 5 full-service restaurants and a hotel property in one of the main brands that most people recognize is called 49th State Brewing Company. It's located in Denali, Anchorage, and now it's Ted Seasons Airport. I wanted to thank the House Labor Commerce Committee for taking the time to find a solution at building a stronger community. And today, on record, I would like to speak in strong support of the changes on HB 189. I think that all of us can agree that part of the solution to our labor shortage is HB 189 and the changes that it's made. But I'd like to take the time today to explain the importance on how this bill and the changes that it's going to make will actually build a stronger community and also debunk the myths surrounding this bill. Debunking this danger, there are already systems in place and policies in place that actually we have to follow currently today. If there were so many dangers about changing the law to allow 18 to 21-year-old people, this would be a national debate because we are only one of 3 states in our nation that has not adopted these changes. We currently operate under licensed facility, are required to train our staff, and no one under the law in the age of 21, guests or staff, are allowed to consume alcohol. You are required to take TAP certified training, which means that all ages are educated on alcohol consumption. This will only enhance and improve our communities by educating younger adults about the concerns and the awareness of alcohol consumption. 47 states already have allowed 18 plus to serve alcohol or move alcohol within a licensed facility. The course has already been cut by 47 states before us. We can follow and learn from those states and avoid any potential concerns or pitfalls moving forward in our great state of Alaska. When you look at the problem, the International Youth Foundation has reported that youth critically need life and employability skills as a way to prepare them to be motivated and confident decision makers who can overcome diversity and realize their potential. The International Youth Foundation has recognized hospitality is one of the key elements of employment that can give these unique, needed life skills. Some developed economies see 100% enrollment in secondary school, yet nearly 1 in 5 students do not require a minimum level of basic skill that allow them to function well in society. Hospitality is a noble career path. The service of others is important to build the health and sustainability of a community. Restaurants create a sense of place in the community, and all of us have learned that very tough lesson during COVID-19 when we were forced to close. The solution in approving HB 189. 1 in every 3 Americans has their first employment job in a restaurant and food service industry. Hospitality builds self-confidence, the ability to manage people's emotions, personal responsibility, respecting self and others, cooperating teamwork, creative diversity thinking, creative thinking, problem solving, decision making, and even conflict management, which is something that's more important today than ever. Hospitality industry shatters the diversity and inclusion numbers across almost all other industries. 54% in hospitality are women. Over 40% are non-white employees. This would allow the youth in our communities to interact with a wider range of social groups and feel more confident in themselves as well as interaction with others. In hospitality, the gender pay gap for entry-level employees is also 6% higher on average in the national reporting. This industry provides additional options for women over other industries. So why would this be good for young adults in this law change? It broadens their skill sets. It's creating flexible shifts in hours, which creates a higher dollar return for young adults. It creates a more sociable and fun job. There are more hours available during holiday breaks, which is a key element, especially at those key years between 18 and 21. Overall, allowing Bill HB 189 to be approved, it not only helps the immediate labor need, but it will impact our community through hospitality employment of our young adults, which will develop our future leaders in our community. And in closing, I would just like to say that I have moved here from the state of Illinois, and this law in the state of Illinois had already been in effect. I am actually a living proof that this law works. From 18 to 21 in the state of Illinois, it was already passed. My direction in life was moving as an architect. Because of my youthful years being allowed to work in hospitality, I found a love, a diversity, and an inclusion there that developed me into who I am today. My move into Alaska and the development of over 5 restaurants now in Alaska, a growing brewing industry, and a hotel is a direct result of a law that has already been in place and successful in 47 of other states. We look forward to being supported. If you have any other questions, please let me know. And our company employs over 650 employees in Alaska as of today. Thank you.
Thank you. next, we have Diane Thompson. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity to speak, and I'll be very brief. I'm Diane Thompson. I'm with Alaska Hospitality Retailers in Anchorage, well, in Alaska, and I'm one of the owners of Firetap Ale House and Restaurant in Anchorage, and I'm in total support of House Bill 189. As it's been said several times already, we're one of 3 states in the U.S. that doesn't allow 18 to 20-year-olds to serve alcohol. And as you are all aware, there's a significant shortage of workers all across the board in Alaska. Some of our servers at our restaurant are working 2 consecutive shifts due to this shortage, especially on the weekends. With visitor season soon approaching and college students coming home, they'll be looking for summer work. Some of these students have student loans in Alaska. And right now they're paying 6.5% to 7% interest on those loans. If we were able to employ these young adults between the ages of 18 and 20 as servers, it would be a huge benefit for both the employee and the employer. Most of the servers at our restaurant make between $30 and $45 an hour with their tips. As it is now, the only job we can offer them when they come home for the summer or winter break is as a host or hostess or a busser at $12 to $14 an hour. So this bill would be a huge help to not only to the hospitality industry, but also to our students, and hoping to keep maybe some of those students in Alaska instead of going back out to other states. Anyway, thank you very much for the chance to speak. And I certainly hope this passes. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Cody Costello. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, am I heard there?
Yes, you are. Go ahead.
Through the chair, my name is Cody Costello. I'm the President and Chief Operating Officer of Alaska Center for the Performing Arts and General Manager of Broadway Alaska. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss the benefits of HB 189 today. Alaska Center for the Performing Arts has been in operation for over 35 years. We partner with presenters and producers from Alaska and around the world to provide world-class arts experiences to our community, including from 8 resident companies. This season, we launched our program, Broadway Alaska, a multi-year partnership with the Nederlander Organization. Our inaugural season is well underway. We've presented the national tours of Hamilton, Come From Away, and Six, already generating over $20 million of economic impact for downtown Anchorage. This is from our Broadway program alone, not to mention all of the other events hosted at the PAC. We understand the importance of our role as an economic engine for downtown Anchorage and Alaska. We've seen patrons from all over the country and cities all across Alaska for our new Broadway program, and we're just getting started. We're excited to bring Disney's Aladdin in April. HB 189 allows us to continue this work, expanding our local business operations and revenue while enhancing the theater experience for our patrons. Under our current alcohol license, workers are limited. Patrons may only consume alcohol in upper-level lobbies and within time frames, and there is no alcohol allowed in the theaters. HB 189 provides an updated framework for the rules of our license, giving us flexibility to finally be able to respond to presenters, promoters, and patrons' requests for evolving the experience and elevating the experience at the PAC and keeping with industry trends. In this spirit, Alaska Center for the Performing Arts requests this licensing change and supports this licensing change to accommodate our clients and patrons and ensure their experience at the theater is relaxed and responsible, and that our venue and services reflect the type of experience our patrons seek and that we can support and promote. Currently, if a patron purchases a drink during a 15 to 20 minute intermission, they need to procure, drink, and be back in their seats within minutes. The system is rushed, unnecessary, and leads to a harried atmosphere and product waste. We have an existing and robust operations plan for all events at the PAC, with well-trained event staff and contracted security, and contracted concessionaire. We're poised to scale up and adjust our operations as needed to ensure that our continued and successful operations with the passing of HB 189 and removing of the existing restrictions in our current license. HB 189 increases our economic impact on and for downtown Anchorage. It drives increased operating revenue to help us reinvest in the facility and personnel. It keeps our theater license in line with the national standards and increases the quality of our patron experience. It's a win for local business, the arts in Alaska, and the lively downtown experience that we all help to curate in Anchorage. Thank you to Representative Sumner and his staff, Clark and Serena, for their work on this bill and to contributing to the vibrancy and economy of downtown Anchorage. I am available for questions anytime, and thank you so much for your support.
Thank you. Next, we have Cindy Hamilton. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Cindy Hamilton, if you're on, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Okay.
Through the chair, this is Cody Costello again. Cindy Hamilton is another staff person. I believe she was only going to be listening in her capacity today.
Oh, okay. Sorry. We had her down for invited testimony, but that's okay.
Apologies. I just got that note. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Do any committee members have any questions?
Yeah,
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Costello, just curious if you have young people between the ages of 18 and 21 who are currently working productions at the PAC, which is what we call it, the PAC or the PAC, what other limitations are there on their hours of operation or hours they can work? Or just how else are there any constraints on the ability to use younger workers between 18 and 21 at the theater?
We don't have very many. Occasionally we will, they can work backstage. They can work the stagehand union, IATSE Local 918. We can employ them in the ticket office and administrative offices. Just with the current capacity, they would not be available for working in our concessions and food service areas.
And a follow-up?
Yep.
And through the chair, Ms. Costello, if this bill were to become law, where do you think you might, the PAC might employ young people? What part of the operation?
I can see an expansion in our front of house services, everywhere from house managers, also allowance of expanding our volunteer usher corps, which is not are not paid positions, but are certainly available. And then, of course, our concessionaire would have the ability to hire personnel in that age range for concession services.
Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, we will set this bill aside for future hearing with public testimony. moving on to House Bill 226, Pharmacies, Pharmacists, Benefits, Managers, a bill from my office. I will now invite Serena Hackenmiller, my staff, to please approach the committee and start your presentation.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Serena Hackmiller, staff to Chair Sumner. I'm going to be reading this sponsor statement, and I'd like to request to the chair, for the sake of time, that we forego the sectional today.
We will today, yeah. Thank you.
Okay, so HB 226 aims to address staff to Chair Sumner. House Bill 226 aims to address critical issues related to the Board of Pharmacy Insurance, pharmacies, pharmacists, and pharmacy benefits managers in the state of Alaska. This comprehensive legislation is designed to ensure patient choice of pharmacy, improve transparency and accountability in pharmacy benefit management, and enhance the standards for pharmaceutical care across the state. HB 226 emphasizes the powers of the Board of Pharmacy, including provisions for licensing, inspection, and regulation of pharmacies, pharmacists, and other entities involved in the distribution of drugs. It also seeks to establish safeguards for patient access to pharmacy services and clinician-administered drugs while preventing unfair trade practices by insurers and pharmacy benefits managers. This legislation introduces provisions for the reimbursement of pharmacy services, addressing issues related to national average drug acquisition costs and dispensing fees, with the goal of ensuring fair compensation for pharmacies and pharmacists. House Bill number 226 is a critical step forward in promoting the best interests of patients, pharmacies, and pharmacists in Alaska. By enacting this legislation, we strive to create an environment that fosters quality pharmaceutical care, empowers patient choice, and enhances the overall integrity of pharmacy services in our state. This legislation is scheduled to take effect on July 1st, 2025, and represents a collaborative effort to modernize and improve the pharmaceutical landscape in Alaska.
Okay, thank you. And we're going to go into invited testimony. We have Brandy Siegmartin. I think I always say that wrong, but if you'd like to approach, put your name on the record and begin your presentation.
And Chair Sumner?
Yep.
Would it be okay to invite my colleague Dan Nelson to join me?
Oh, yeah.
Help present?
Go ahead.
Thank you. All right. Good afternoon, Chair Sumner and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Brandy Siegmartin. I'm a pharmacist and I'm the executive director of the Alaska Pharmacy Association.
And my name is Dan Nelson. I'm the Director of Pharmacy at Tandon Chiefs Conference in Fairbanks, Alaska, and thank you for the opportunity to come speak to you today to this important bill.
All right. Thank you so much for hearing this bill today. This is just a quick roadmap of what we'll be discussing today, what are pharmacy benefit managers, how they contribute to increased costs, and then discuss the bill in front of you. So pharmacy benefit managers are third-party companies that act as intermediaries between insurance companies, drug manufacturers, pharmacies, and patients. Though they were created to actually decrease the cost of the spend that we spend on drugs, they've actually become incentivized to increase that spend because they actually create and manage all of the formularies or what drugs are covered. They negotiate the rebates with our friends at the drug manufacturers who they actually use that money to contribute to our plans, which is really beneficial, and nothing in this bill gets rid of that practice. They manage the pharmacy networks, and then they operate their own mail order or specialty pharmacies out of state. So these are some of the ways that they contribute to the cost. So like we were talking about the rebates and fees, people ask why do drugs cost so much in the United States? Well, we are the only country in the world that actually has pharmacy benefit managers. And so they directly negotiate with the pharmaceutical manufacturers to decrease the drug spend for our plan sponsors. That's one of the issues that is not addressed in this bill. They are incentivized to put higher cost drugs on the formularies. So the first time I was the pharmacist working and I went to dispense a $10 version of a drug and got the claim denied and it said, no, you have to dispense the higher cost version. That was really confusing to me as the pharmacist because I thought, doesn't it make sense to dispense the lowest cost drug? Well, I've learned since that PBMs actually get reimbursed more based on the cost of the drug, which is the issue here. One of the biggest issues we'll talk about extensively is also spread pricing. And then we've talked extensively in some of the other committees where most of you are in the House Health and Social Services Committee about the harms to Alaska. But I wanted to turn over to Dan to talk a little bit more about what we're seeing.
Yeah, thank you, Brandy. As this slide alludes to, PBMs really are harming the fabric of Alaskan pharmacies and Alaskan healthcare. Just in the last 5 or 6 years, we've seen a quarter of the independent pharmacies in the state of Alaska close, and it's just been a hit parade of more of them being on either closing or being on the verge of closure over the last couple of years. This also does not just impact the small independent pharmacies. It also impacts the chains and tribal health organizations. So we've seen numbers that have looked at risk of up to 35% of pharmacies closing within the next year due to the low reimbursement rates from pharmacy benefit managers. Going to move on to the next slide here. Pharmacy benefit managers have been in the news a lot lately, and unfortunately, none of that news has been good. A lot of it has had to do with shortages of pharmacists, cutting hours, pharmacies closing unexpectedly, lack of access to pharmacies. One of the things that's been in the big national news lately is a big cyber attack on one of the subsidiary of one of the major insurance companies that also owns a pharmacy benefit manager. It's frankly been the most crippling cyber attack on the United States healthcare system ever. I think the importance of this is just cannot be understated. And the fact that we have these companies that are frankly paying the bills, but also holding the keys to the cookie jar is just a very dangerous precedent. And I think that's why we're seeing investigations by the Federal Trade Commission and others, Congress and basically all 50 states are looking at this industry quite closely. I think just taking it closer to home, I just had a conversation yesterday with a pharmacy owner in the Mat-Su Valley. They're actually in the Anchorage area that has been open 26 years. He's had a pharmacist that's worked for him for 24 of those 26 years. Just within the last 3 months, he had to let that pharmacist go. He can no longer pay because of his reimbursement rates and the fees and basically extortion that PBMs are exerting on his business. He's gone from, at one point, he had 7 full-time benefited employees. He now has 0 full-time employees, all part-time employees, and none of them have any benefits. So I think this is a real deal. He has explained to me that he is very much at risk of going out of business over the next year. And so I think that we have not seen the end of this. And so I'm not trying to be hyperbolic, but I really do feel like change is needed very soon. This time is of the essence. Wanted to just to point out, this is again jumping back, looking at the big picture of what's gone on in the industry with vertical integration of these companies. So they now really own the entire food chain from the insurance company to the group purchasing organizations, specialty pharmacies, mail order pharmacies. They're actually physicians' offices. And now, amazingly enough, if people can even wrap their heads around this, the pharmacy benefit managers are actually going into drug manufacturing businesses. So not only are they making the drugs, they're saying that the only drug that we're going to cover is the drug that we ourselves make. So if that's not a conflict of interest and why the Federal Trade Commission has not stepped in more quickly on that issue is really, frankly, mind-boggling. But I did want to point out these are really the biggest companies there are. So we've got the Fortune 500 list of the companies here. We've got four of them that are in the top 15 of the Fortune 500. So these are extraordinarily rich and powerful companies. You'll often hear, as people talk about this industry, about the big three. The big three are OptumRx, Express Scripts, and CVS Health. These three companies are responsible for roughly 80 plus percent of the prescriptions that are covered in the United States of America. So where that becomes quite problematic is it's actually multifaceted, but one of the biggest ways is through their contracting process. So typically a contracting process, as we think about it in the layman's terms, is a mutually agreed upon back and forth process. In this world, there's nothing about that. It's a completely unilateral process where the PBMs themselves hold all the cards. So I'm not going to belabor this point, but I would just say that it right now is really a situation where the PBMs hold all the cards. And frankly, when we look at some of these investigations that have gone into their practices, the FTC has been investigating them for 18 months, and they really just put out the senators that were pushing for some of this investigation, just got an update on that, and essentially they've got information back that the PBMs are stonewalling and not giving them the information they need to conduct their investigation completely. I'm going to take this
one, Randy. Yeah, so spread pricing, and on its face, spread pricing looks like it is what every good business person does, right? They buy something for less than they sell it for. The problem with spread pricing in this context is that it is pernicious and it is ubiquitous. It is all over the place. And when we hear our friends talk about that they're auditing their PBMs, one of the biggest problems that we see with that is that that audit oftentimes ends on the PBM side, and we don't know until a state legislature or somebody comes in and gets interested and there actually becomes an investigation where they look at the pharmacy claims as well. That's oftentimes when we see the true spread is. And spread pricing is really dangerous because what happens is plan sponsors are getting charged significantly more, and pharmacies are getting paid significantly less, and oftentimes less than the price that they're actually paying for the drug. So there's a quick example. Say, I want to show you like kind of how this works. So say you're going to have a lunch and learn that your office is hosting and you have a budget of $100. So you send one of your staff out, they have $100 in their pocket to get you as much salmon as they can get, because this lunch and learn is going to be on the Alaska salmon industry. So they go out to a local commercial fisherman down at the dock, say, hey, we want to contract with you to get as much salmon as we can for this lunch and learn. The fisherman says, great, we're going to do it. They go and get the fish, come back. And then the staff person actually says, well, I actually have to keep this as an administrative fee, so I'm only going to give you $10, even though we originally agreed on more. They go, and then the fisherman's obviously upset. And the staff person says, well, if you tell anyone about this transaction, I'm actually going to go back to my powerful job with the state and make sure your commercial fishing license is revoked. That is how these contracts work with pharmacies. Pharmacies are essentially not allowed to talk about them, and they have such little negotiating power, and this is really harming our local infrastructure and access to pharmacy and pharmaceuticals.
So looking at this real world, kind of what's happened in Alaska, so we looked at one pharmacy's reimbursements on all of their commercial and Medicare Part D plans, so this excluded Medicaid, but these were about 70,000 prescriptions. Of those 70,000 prescriptions, we filtered out those ones that were reimbursed less than a dollar. That was about 35,000 of those prescriptions, so roughly 50% of those prescriptions, and they came out to an average of about 47 cents reimbursement per prescription. So we're looking at these drugs. Just to purchase those drugs was about $366,000. What was reimbursed was $16,000. I don't know about you guys, but it's pretty crappy business model to spend $360,000 on something and only get paid $16,000 back on it. And so we kind of took that the next step and looked at what the actual plans were getting charged for that. So we had some ways to look at some additional data, and we looked at what the plans were getting charged. So again, pharmacies reimbursed $16,000. Plans are charged for those claims about $832,000. So that spread of $816,000 is the difference. This is just one Alaskan pharmacy on about 35,000 claims. So these are really big numbers, really fast.
I guess we could just talk about this briefly, which is that the black box of spread pricing is really a place where PBMs do not want us to look in. This is something that, again, this practice really needs to be banned. Congress is working on it, but we know that we can't rely on them to get the job done. And we know that in several, this is just two examples, but in many other states, they've uncovered millions of dollars in additional spread through investigations in their state plans that are happening. And in the Alaska Care data that Dan is going to walk us through here in a few minutes, we actually don't know what the spread is in Alaska Care. And it seems like maybe nobody does, which that concerns me as a citizen, as well as a pharmacist. I hope it concerns all of you because it's something that is a really big problem. So anti-competitive, should we take a question? Oh, restate my name for the record. Thank you, Brandy Signamartin, for the record. So all of these practices that PBMs are engaging in are really anti-competitive and unfair trade practices. So the monopolistic power that PBMs have, they use it to control the flow of commerce out of the state of Alaska, which is a really big problem. Some of the practices that they use to discourage or squash competition include demanding ludicrous fees and contracting requirements for local pharmacies wanting to dispense what they consider to be specialty drugs. Additionally, they contractually disallow local pharmacies from mailing prescriptions due to competition with local pharmacies. It makes a heck of a lot more sense for Tanana Chiefs Conference to mail a prescription from Fairbanks to their constituents in Anaktuvik Pass than it makes for a PBM to mail it from somewhere in the lower 48 to that same person, essentially. So this is a practice that we, as a state, the state really needs to step in and say, no, you cannot put that in contracts anymore. That's really just not okay. Additionally, as we'll talk about in a minute, PBMs, when they do use their power to control the flow of prescription commerce out of the state of Alaska to their own mail order pharmacies, they actually pay them more, and not just a little bit more. It's fairly significant. So this is a chart from a study out of Florida. However, we found recently in some of the data that Dan's going to look at, the data that we've analyzed from the Department of Retirement and Benefits has mirror images to some of the data we've seen in these other reports. So Alaska is not an exception. We are the rule. We have the same things happening here in Alaska that we've seen in other states. So not to get too far into the details, but you can see the local pharmacies. So in this particular area, those were the local brick and mortar pharmacies. And then the tall green boxes are the mail order pharmacies owned by the PBMs. And what this chart is showing is how much the PBM was reimbursing that pharmacy over the acquisition cost for a specific drug. And as you can see, they pay their own pharmacies more, and not just a little bit more. It's up to like around $200 more, or 200 times more in this case, which is very problematic.
And we're going to have to take a brief at ease. I'm going to turn this over to Representative Ruffridge. So at ease.
We are back on record. Please introduce yourselves again for the record. Apologies for the brief at ease, but Representative Sumner had a meeting he had to attend, so please continue and just introduce yourself for the record. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Brandy Signamartin.
My name is Dan Nelson, and I think I'm going to take this next slide. So one of the questions is to whom PBMs are currently responsible to. So right now, the answer is that they're responsible to their shareholders, not to the patients that they serve, not to the employers, not to the insurance companies they work for. They're essentially responsible to their shareholders. So this is kind of across the board. This impacts private employers, patients in all walks of life in the state of Alaska. So I think that there's kind of a misconception. I work for a tribal health organization that this doesn't affect patients with Alaska Native, American Indian that receive their care at tribal health organizations. It absolutely does, because it we'll get into this in a little bit more detail, but it definitely diminishes the overall revenue of the tribal health organizations, and frankly, in a way that is breaking federal law on a daily basis. That's a whole.
Representative Fields. Through the chairs, of the Title 21 provisions in the bill that would protect THOs from what you see as PBM abuses, or is there another section of the bill that would do that, or section of statutes? Which section of statutes affect tribal health organizations?
Through the chair, there is not a specific call out for tribal health organizations within the bill. I think that it's the overall protections of the bill that would positively impact the bottom line of tribal health organizations and the patients that we serve, but there's not a specific call out. We've, in fact, just this morning had some kind of offline conversations about that potential, whether that would be appropriate or not, but that is something that is currently kind of on our radar, but it's not currently in the bill.
Follow up? Continue.
All right. So we've, you know, briefly walked through what some of the issues are. So just want to talk about a little bit what is in the bill. So really at its essence, this is a patient freedom of pharmacy choice bill. And this gives patients the right to access the medication safely at the pharmacy of their choice. So it really bans patient steering and, you know, in all areas of pharmaceutical care. It ensures patients have safe access to physician-administered medications. And this is the practices of white bagging and brown bagging. These are practices used for when a patient requires a physician-administered medication. There's nothing in this bill, I just want to clarify, that affects the site of care for those infusions. It really is about ensuring a safe chain of custody for the medication itself. And then this bill requires a transparent reimbursement model. And really, that is more important than anything else as far as what the reimbursement model could look like. 39 other states have PBM bills in front of them. A lot of them have varying reimbursement models in the bill, because in 2020, the Supreme Court said, yes, all states can regulate health plans based on the reimbursement floor of a drug. And that is really important when we look at this particular provision and making sure that we want to bring transparency, which is why this bill requires a reimbursement floor of NADAC plus a dispensing fee. And I'm actually going to turn it over to Dan to talk a little bit more about what that means specifically.
Representative Sather.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, before we move on, could you please explain, Dr. Martin, what is white bagging and brown bagging?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Sadler. So white bagging and brown bagging are practices where when a drug is approved by the FDA only to be administered by a clinician. So these are oftentimes like chemotherapy drugs for cancer is a really common one that you can think of. And what the practice is when the PBM mandates that the drug comes from their own pharmacy. Because these are high-cost drugs, and as we talked about, PBMs use their monopolistic power to steer the flow of prescription commerce away from our local pharmacies and clinics into their own hands, right? So they want to be the ones to dispense it so that they can then remunerate themselves and remunerate themselves at a higher level, right? So the problem is, comes in when now, so white bagging is when the drug goes to the patient's clinic or the site where it will be administered. And the problem with this practice, even though it might seem, oh, well, it's going straight to the clinic. The problem is I hear from clinics all the time, this doesn't come with their normal drugs that come in directly into the pharmacy and are stored and handled in a particular way. These come through the mailroom. So it might come in on a Friday afternoon and it sits in the mailroom all weekend. Nobody knows what it is because it's not through the proper supply chain. It's really problematic, not only the mail situation that is problematic. Also, it goes around all of the protections and systems that health systems have put in place to ensure that patients are getting the right drug at the right time. And so there's really a system that's like right for medication errors because it just circumvents all of that. And then brown bagging is the same practice, but it goes to the patient's home rather than the clinic, which adds even extra layers of product integrity issues and concerns, because now, you know, the product could have been sitting in the patient's mailbox where it could be frozen or mishandled in some way. And then they bring it in, and then the clinic or health system is then responsible to ensure that the patient's safety throughout this process. So a lot of our health systems have actually gone away from using this as much as they can, but it's really problematic when the PBMs require it.
If I may, through the chair, that's a lot of good information, and it's a little bit overwhelming. So brown bagging is when an infusion medicine goes directly to the patient's home. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that is correct.
Very good. And through the chair again, through white bagging is when the medicine goes from the manufacturer to the, I'm assuming it's an infusion, so where the medication is injected into someone's veins. That's the second one.
Through the chair.
That's good to know. That, and the implications of that, what's good, bad, and different, that makes more sense, but not terminology I'm used to. But good. Okay, thank you very much.
Representative Fox.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Do you know if we're going to hear from the state vision of commerce or law? Because a lot of this seems to me to affect interstate commerce and Federal Trade Commission and et cetera. And I'm wondering if we're getting into a legal gray area.
Thank you, Representative Prox. For invited testimony today, I have Dr. Sigmartin, Dr. Schaber, Dr. Nelson, and Ms. Molina, who is online for Teams. I believe, looking ahead, there will be additional testimony at a different time, potentially not today on that request, Representative Prox.
Okay, because I don't know that they would... It would be appropriate to be asking them. But through the chair, you did mention a specific, you said there was a Supreme Court case, Supreme Court decision that established this was okay in somewhere else. Do you happen to know the name of that decision?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, that is Rutledge v. PCMA. And that was a 2020 decision.
And that's not to be confused with Ruffridge, Representative Brock.
thank you. Thanks.
It was Rutledge.
Right.
Yes. Okay, very good. Any follow-up?
Nope, that's fine. That's what I need to know.
Any other questions from committee members on this slide?
Well, maybe on that point, Mr. Chairman, we could just ask Ledge Legal to come explain to us why we have what superficially appear to be conflicting decisions. I think there's a Rutledge and the Oklahoma case. And why did the PBM law get struck down? As I understand one case, but not another. And what space do we have? That might be helpful for me.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And before we continue, this is good information, but it might be helpful. I mean, part of you looks at this and says, how do we arrive at the situation where pharmacy benefit managers have this kind of power to have preferential pricing? How do we get to the system we have now, which will help me understand what needs to be done, you know, after with this bill? How do we get to this point?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I think so. One of our colleagues likes to use the analogy of the kudzu plant. If anyone's familiar with that, so it's in the South. They brought this plant over called kudzu, and it helps with to get rid of erosion. And so they had a lot of eroding hills and mountains and stuff. So they used this kudzu to help that problem. However, now kudzu has become the problem because it's so out of control and it's gotten so big and so massive. So that's really when PBMs came in onto the scene many years ago, their really plan was like they're working that adjudication point between the pharmacy and the insurance, because patients don't want to have to come in and pay $1,000 out of their pocket and then get reimbursed later for a drug, right? Yet we're giving them a product, so we can't just not get paid at the pharmacy counter. So that was kind of how they originally came about. They started over time negotiating rebates. Then they started developing this vertical integration model that Dr. Nelson walked us through, that really they have, you know, integrated their power and consolidated it. So PBMs, unlike our regular insurers that we think of, say like Aetna or Premera, right? They are beholden to a lot of different laws at both the state and federal level, including, you know, what percentage of profits they can keep versus they have to reinvest into their covered lives, and many other things, right? But third-party administrators, which is what PBMs are, have totally been outside of that level of regulation. So much to the point what Dan didn't quite mention on but was talking about was that, like, so at the federal level, we have the Indian Health Improvement Act at the federal level, which requires essentially that if a Native person is getting health at a facility, if that service, whatever that service is covered by the insurance anywhere, even if that facility is not in network, they have to pay that facility. So the insurers have to follow those rules, but the PBMs do not. And so they've gotten around, and that's how we've gotten to where we are today, is that they've amassed so much wealth and power throughout this process that these three big ones have gained this monopolistic power so that they can now, again, use that power to steer the flow of prescription commerce. And as on our slide, we had said there are about 21% of other PBMs. So there's like 77 total PBMs, right? So there's about 74 other ones. And many of those actually are transparent and do use these types of models. But it's these big ones that we're really concerned about.
Thank you. Representative Fields.
Thank you. Through the chair, while we're on the topic of profits, I was curious, have you all read the fiscal note from Department of Administration? Okay. The fiscal note from Department of Administration says this bill would increase costs by about $2.5 million. Could you explain why you disagree with the analysis of the DOA fiscal note and why you think what DOA says will cost money, in your view, would save money? Where is their analysis wrong? Thank you.
This is Dan Nelson through the chair. Yes, we strongly disagree with the fiscal note calculation. A couple of points where we feel like it fell short. One is that probably the one biggest one is that they didn't really take into consideration. So when you look at the reimbursement of a prescription drug, there's the two aspects of reimbursement on a outpatient prescription drug. There's the ingredient cost, which is the cost of the actual drug that's in the pill bottle. And then there's also the professional dispensing fee. So we know what this bill, the dispensing fee is going to go up. And we feel like that is what DOA calculated exclusively was the increased amount from the dispensing fee. We know that's going to go up. We acknowledge that completely. What we don't feel like they did a good job of is doing this hard work that we did in calculating the cost savings from going from the current model for the ingredient cost, which is currently makes up 99.5% of reimburse of all drug spend in the state of Alaska, DRB, on the actual ingredient cost, by going from the current model to a transparent model based on national average drug acquisition cost, or NADAC, plus that dispensing fee. And we've crunched those numbers, and that's actually coming right up in the next couple slides in our presentation that will hopefully show that in spades.
And maybe go to those slides now.
Yeah, so I think I just spoke basically to this one, and I'll just keep on going. I think we have a broad basis of support across the healthcare industry. And so here, Representative Fields, through the chair, I think hopefully the slide kind of gets to your question. So through a public records request that Senator Geisel made to the Department of Administration, we were able to get some, we requested 13 data points for the 2022 amount paid by Division of Retirement and Benefits through their Alaska Cares program. Through about a 6-month back and forth process, we got 8 of those fields back. And we did find that they spent about $277 million in 2022. When we've gone back and calculated those numbers, one of the unfortunate things that we did not get from them that Senator Geisel requested was the fill date on those prescriptions. That information was considered proprietary, and they would not share that information with us. So why there is this range, and there's these two numbers on this particular slide, and you'll see the NADAC low and the NADAC high, is because the NADAC is, which is what the floor pricing of the ingredient cost is in House Bill 226. That is a number that's published weekly, so 52 times a year that number is published, and so it's going to fluctuate throughout the year. So we looked at, if we looked at the lowest NADAC, which we know this isn't totally a realistic number, or the highest, it's absolutely is going to be somewhere in between. But we're confident through our calculations, we're just looking at the state of Alaska Division of Retirement and Benefits data, we're looking at anywhere from about a $7.9 million to a $0.7 million dollar savings. So on average, if you average this out, it comes out to about $4.3 million is our estimation of the cost savings looking at 2022 data. So again, strongly disagree with their estimates because we frankly don't believe that they were done.
Mr. Chairman, I guess it would be helpful for me to just hear from Steve Ramos at a future hearing on how he came to a different conclusion. Thank you.
Thank you. Continue.
Okay, so our next couple of slides, I wanted to show just a couple of examples that I think that show this information very starkly. This is this particular medication. This is just, again, going back to that 2022 data. This is on the left-hand side there is what the state of Alaska paid for this particular drug called Tecfidera. It's an NS drug. Low volume, just 93 prescriptions filled. All of them were filled at Optum out-of-state pharmacies. One was by their specialty pharmacy. So what the state of Alaska paid was over $400,000 for those 93 prescriptions. If you look at what they would have paid under the pricing formula based off House Bill 226 is about $35,000. So, and that's the maximum, and that's looking at the highest NADAC for 2022. So, well over 1,000% increase. And then one of the claims that you'll hear from our opponents on this bill is that when you use specialty pharmacy, that's one of our mechanisms that we use to provide cost savings. And when we looked at this data, it just the proof's in the pudding. That's not the fact. Actually, they end up spending more when they use a specialty pharmacy. So again, something that we pretty vehemently disagree with. Here's another example of another NS drug called Copaxone. 2022, the state of Alaska filled, I believe this was for about 32 prescriptions. So again, low volume, but high cost. About $150,000 is what they paid in 2022. If we, again, use the House Bill 226 calculations, it would have been roughly half that, so about $75,000. When we went to the from the retail pharmacy to the specialty pharmacy, that single prescription cost went up by $1,000 per prescription.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair. I just want to probe some of these slides. So if filled by a specialty pharmacy, additional $1,000 per prescription. You're saying that the cost would have gone up under the SOA paid bar. We could add about $32,000, so it would be about $185,000 if it was filled by a specialty pharmacy. Hey, is that correct?
Through the chair, this is what was actually paid. If all of them would have been filled at a specialty pharmacy, I don't have the numbers right off the top of my head, but I believe that was a small volume of them that were actually filled at the Optum specialty pharmacy. So this is what was actually paid, but it would have, when you compare apples to apples, that same exact same drug, same everything else, same quantity, same volume, when it was filled at the pharmacy, the specialty tag on it, the Optum charged $1,000 more per prescription.
So to follow up, so we know that some of that $153,000 included that extra $1,000 if it was filled in a prescription, especially pharmacy. Got that. So can I draw any conclusions based on the $1,000 prescription for the specialty pharmacy under the $75,000? Would this bill would HB 226 eliminate the opportunity for that extra $1,000 because it was filled at a specialty pharmacy?
That's correct. Yes, no, through the chair. Excuse me. That's correct because the definition of what a specialty pharmacy would allow a more Alaskan pharmacies and local pharmacies to qualify and to be able to fill those prescriptions and meet those current restrictions they put on those pharmacies.
Great, thanks.
Okay, one last and I think really stark example is one last MS drug. Just shows the drastic multiple thousands of times more that the PBMs are paying at their own cell phone pharmacies, roughly 200,000 versus this is a top number. If we use the high NADAC for the entire year of 2022, we would have, and this also, excuse me, I forgot to include, this also includes the dispensing fee that you'll hear the opponents of this bill kind of really put a laser focus on. Again, the dispensing fee is really becomes a drop in the bucket when you look at how expensive these drugs are because of the ingredient costs are so high. So again, less than $10,000 compared to almost $200,000 for one individual drug. So over 3,000 times more when you use the Optum mail order pharmacy than what would have been paid through Hospital 226 calculations. So moving on, we want to look at overall cost savings on a bigger scale, more than just the Division of Retirement and Benefits. So we looked at some Kaiser Family Foundation data, and we looked at what the cost savings would have been, again, using the high and low NADAC values. So for 2022, we're looking at a range of anywhere from about $43 or $44 million to about $4 million. And this is for all Alaskan employers combined, based off some 2019 data from Kaiser Family Foundation.
Representative Fields?
I think I would like to get a lot more explanation on how you all came to this slide. And when you say Alaska employers, what's the breakdown? Alaska Care, Title 21 plans, ERISA plans, and among ERISA plans, your muni plans as well as your private employer plans.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll be happy to share that with you.
Representative Sadler? Continue.
Okay, so also wanted to touch on one of the aspects of House Bill 226 is that it prevents the mandatory mail order of prescriptions. It does not say that prescriptions cannot go through mail order. I want to make that abundantly clear that this bill does not prevent the allowance if patients want to do that and plans allow for it, that patients still can do mail order. But I did want to point out that if we looked at all the prescriptions that are currently being mail ordered, if they were brought back into the state, the economic impact of this is significant. Again, be happy to share some more information of how we came to these numbers, but we're looking in the range of $35 million if we brought all these prescriptions annually, if we brought all these prescriptions that are currently being sent out of state and brought them back in state to brick and mortar pharmacies in the state of Alaska. Okay, and then we wanted to look at just the gross economic impact of the infusion without the forced mail, and then to include the dispensing fee. And again, this gets quite a bit of the weeds, but when we look at the overall mail order and the ingredient costs, we're looking at nearly $200 million brought into the state of Alaska annually. So one of the things that we've been talking about throughout this process is that we really have problems with the current vertical integration and these big monopoly companies that really have a chokehold on the market right now. And it's not that the pharmacists in the state of Alaska are feeling that all PBMs are bad. There really are some good PBMs. This is a great example. The White House just had a listening session about healthcare costs and particularly about prescription drugs. I would definitely love to share that information with everyone. But this is a gentleman, Dr. Jared Price, out of the state of Kansas, that actually runs a pharma, or actually several pharmacies and a transparent PBM that does not have spread pricing, does not retain rebates, does not have specialty pharmacy requirements, has a flat administrative fee, and then ends up still saving municipalities hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars annually.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of have to probe a little bit on this. So OReadRx is the name of a transparent PBM. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
And it's owned by Dr. Jared Price, right?
Through the chair, that's correct. Okay.
And the SB 121 is not the bill before us. Is that a Alaska State Senate bill, or is that a?
That's through the chair. That's correct. That apology on the slide. No, it should be House Bill 226.
There's just a lot going on. I just want to make sure I understand. So, and this is the alleged or the claimed benefits of transparent prescription benefits manager, and those benefits are no spread pricing, or these characteristics, or these the benefits. Those four blocks.
Through the chair, that's correct.
It's correct that those are benefits?
Through the chair, yes.
Good. Let me make sure. Thanks.
Representative Fields.
Through the chair, what is the admin fee in OReadRx?
Through the chair, I actually don't know what it is, but it's flat and transparent, which is in direct opposition to what we see currently with especially the big PBMs, where they tell the plan sponsors, well, if you just let us do spread pricing, it'll be less of a fee. But really, it just goes into that black box of the spread pricing, and we don't really know how much we're actually paying for the administrative fees, essentially.
If I could follow up, maybe we could just try to find that information. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Continue, please. Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. And I know we don't know what the flat administrative fee is, but do we know if that's something that's statutorily set, or is it something that that company has just decided to take on as their flat administrative fee?
Through the chair, that that is something that's negotiated. It's not statutorily set. It's negotiated between the PBM and the plan sponsor.
Okay.
Representative Sather.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, because I do want to understand the message of this slide. I'm going to ask you to explain. Again, this is your business, so clients and the provider, just kind of claim, help me understand where in the process the clients are and what is paid, passive voice, what is paid to the provider by whom. Help me understand the no spread pricing in simple language, if you can, please. Who are the clients? Who's the provider?
Through the chair, with spread pricing, just kind of a layman's explanation of that is that the PBM negotiates what is going to be reimbursed for the prescription drug with the plan, so that or plan sponsor. So that's one thing, and that's what the PBM charges the plan sponsor. There's a separately negotiated rate that they negotiate with the pharmacy. That is a lesser amount. So the difference between what they negotiate with the pharmacy and the plan sponsor is the spread.
I might be able to help Representative Sather.
What's the sponsor?
In the no spread pricing field, if you use the state of Alaska as an example, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Nelson, the client in this case would be the state of Alaska. The state of Alaska were to employ O-Read Rx, and the provider would be providers of services. In this case, that would be a pharmacy. Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, I guess the obvious question, or I'm not understanding this, why doesn't everybody switch to O-Read Rx?
Through the chair, I actually will, this is Brandy Sigmund-Martin, share a little bit. So there is a link on here to a 5-minute video of Dr. Price's brief testimony at the White House listening session recently. But actually, one of the issues is vertical integration. So we showed that slide earlier with the vertical integration. What he actually testifies to at the White House is that for a lot of plans, for the plan sponsor, who is the employer, to sometimes opt out of using the integrated or vertically integrated PBM services, they have to pay a large fee. And so this just speaks to the monopolistic power held by these large PBMs, that even the plan sponsor, if you want to use a transparent PBM, the PBMs, essentially these big PBMs that are vertically integrated, basically they will find a way to get the money from you, essentially, is part of the problem. And so it's because of that system that it is really hard. We would love, and that's why we wanted to share this information, we would love and we want to incentivize people to more move towards these models. And if more of our employers did move towards using these transparent PBMs, any of the 74 outside of those big three that are really harming our public health infrastructure, we would all be much better off, for sure.
Well,
yes. Through the chair, that still leaves the question, and forgive me, this is a little bit beyond my comprehension, but what is, you're saying the vertical integration of PBMs with insurance companies, but on the other hand, some insurance company must be using O-Red Rx. I would think, I don't know.
Through the chair, I guess my thought is that I think that the light bulbs are starting to go off, and as you've alluded to, and I think that Mark Cuban was another one. Mark Cuban's Cost Plus Drugs. He also testified at this White House listening session that even CEOs in America don't understand how this whole model works. You guys are smart people. I think this is an extremely complicated system, intentionally so. And so I think that what's happening is that we've seen some very big employers. The state of California has looked at this. Tyson Foods has recently gone away from one of these big three. They're one of the biggest private employers in the United States of America, and have gone to a transparent PBM model. And I think that is going to be the trend of the future. And I think that you'll actually have started to see some of the big three PBMs are trying to paint themselves in this light that they are going to be in this more transparent model. The reality is they need to take a lot more steps than they currently are to make that a reality.
Right. As much as I enjoy this topic, we do have two other bills in front of us today. I will let you guys get through your slides. We do still have a couple of other invited testifiers. Oh, excellent. And Representative Carrick did have a question.
Thank you, through the chair. And we can probably talk about this a lot more, too, as individual offices. But I'm just struggling with how our system got like this. I know that question was asked earlier. But if PBMs are supposed to be the third-party companies that are intermediaries between insurance, manufacturers, pharmacies, and they're acting as pharmacies, it sounds like, in some cases, and acting as manufacturers in some cases, and working vertically integrated with insurance companies as well, how is this not a violation of antitrust laws on the federal level? Why hasn't it been addressed? And why does it need to be addressed on a state level from your perspective? And I'll just say, to caveat that, I've seen a lot of local pharmacies in Alaska talk to a lot of local pharmacists who have gone out of business as a result, in large part, of this structure. So I would agree that something needs to happen, but why hasn't it happened on a federal level, and why is the state the most appropriate entity to take action?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, those are excellent questions. And I think some that we're all asking ourselves of, how did we get this far down the road without having some real change put in place? And so part of it does go back to that vertical integration and how over time they've just built slowly. And so a year and a half ago, 18 months ago or a little more, the Federal Trade Commission did launch an investigation into the big PBMs and sent out compensatory orders to really look into the data and what is happening there. Just like 2 weeks ago, the FTC came out, the Federal Trade Commission came out and said that the PBMs are not complying with those orders. And so we don't really know what the next steps are. There are several pieces of legislation also being looked at the federal level, because there are some federal plans that this is not going to be able, that we're not going to be able to do anything about at the state level. Medicare Part D, for instance, is, you know, there's some really big problems there. So we do need the federal government to also take action, but there are things that at the state level need to be done, and we're kind of behind the curve at this point as far as what we've seen in other states as well. Thank you.
No. Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair. Before these witnesses leave, I think I'm still struggling to understand the impact on tribal health providers. So if I understand right, for Medicaid beneficiaries, there's a dispensing fee. For IHS beneficiaries, so I guess 100% federally paid, if this bill passed, would there be tribal members who are state employees who would be receiving their medications through a tribal pharmacy, who then would get an additional dispensing fee paid through Alaska Care? Would that happen?
Through the chair, very good question. It does, frankly, get relatively in the weeds and a little bit confusing. But Alaska Medicaid is kind of one of our blessings right now. It really does not use a PBM, and that's one of the ones that we feel like has a good model. Currently, I don't think that's part of, thankfully, it's not one of the things that we're complaining about with Medicaid. As a tribal health pharmacist of over 20 years, we do serve tons of patients with private insurance that continue to seek their care. So it's not just patients that have Medicaid, Medicare. Some patients don't have any insurance. Some people work at the university system, at private employers, and seek their care here at our pharmacy, for example. And so then this bill would still apply to them, and it would make it a fair playing ground. Because right now, the fact of the matter is, as crazy as it sounds, and I'd be happy to have an offline conversation with you to explain how this happens, we literally end up paying PBMs to fill certain prescriptions. So it's negative reimbursement.
So just to make sure I understand, so privately insured individuals using tribal pharmacies are the primary reason that tribal health pharmacies are interested in this book.
Through the chair, that's absolutely correct.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you for your presentation. I'm sure members of this committee will continue to have questions. We do have two other invited testifiers that we will call up. First, Dr. Schaber, current chair of the Board of Pharmacy. Please introduce yourself for the record and provide us your testimony.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Ashley Schaber. I serve as chair of the Alaska Board of Pharmacy. I have lived and worked as a pharmacist in Alaska for over 16 years. I've been a member of the Board of Pharmacy since July of 2021, and I have served as chair since December of 2022. Over the last several years, through public testimony and input from pharmacists and technicians working in Alaska, the Board of Pharmacy became aware of the issues that Dr. Nelson and Dr. Signa Martin brought forward previously. The board identified the negative impact to safety in Alaska and has collaborated with the Alaska Pharmacy Association to help craft language addressing the practices. Multiple other patient and healthcare organizations have also been part of the process and support this effort to ensure adequate pharmacy infrastructure physically in Alaska. The Board of Pharmacy is in unanimous support of House Bill 226 because it gives patients the right to access medications at the pharmacy of their choice if their pharmacy is a willing provider and contracted with the pharmacy benefits manager, provides a framework for transparency and fair reimbursement for pharmacies and patients, protects patient access to clinician-administered medications by restricting the practices of white bagging and brown bagging you heard about previously, and it also aligns with our strategic plan, specifically, which is goal number 4, growing the Alaska economy while promoting community health and safety. This bill is unique in that it addresses both the safety and economic impacts Alaska is experiencing due to the issues described. Our board's mission is to promote, preserve, and protect the public health, safety, and welfare by and through the effective control and regulation of the practice of pharmacy. Over the last few years, the board has received comment from the public, Alaska pharmacists, technicians, and organizations about the current practices limiting access to Alaskan pharmacies and compromising safety of medications received in our state. We have continued to see the negative impacts and recognize that change is needed urgently. Since the effort on House Bill 226 began, multiple Alaska pharmacies have or will close soon, including those providing specialized services such as infusions, compounding, and compliance packaging. House Bill 226 will help ensure that Alaska's pharmacies can continue to safely serve Alaskans. Thank you for hearing this bill today, and I urge your support and quick passage.
Thank you, Dr. Schaber. Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Schaber, thanks for being here and your work on the bill. I'm personally happy to contemplate additional dispensing fees. One thing that concerns me is the larger companies having roughly 80% of market share. So we're spending, you know, $100 in additional state money, other plans, and $20 of those are going to community pharmacies. And I just wondered if you had reflected on what are all the options available to us to most efficiently support community pharmacy without, in my view, wasting money on these larger corporations that I don't really have an interest in subsidizing. And feel free to get back to us later if you want to think it over more.
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Fields, I can definitely look into that a little bit more. I would say the premise of the bill is to allow Alaskans to choose. And so putting a limitation on that would go against the original premise of the bill.
All right. No other questions? Thank you for your testimony. We will move now to Desiree Molina. Thank you for being online. Please introduce yourself for the record, and please begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Desiree Molina. I'm from Palmer, Alaska. I'm currently a fourth-year student in the UAA ISU Doctor of Pharmacy program. I'm also employed as a pharmacist intern at Three Bears Pharmacy in the Mat-Su Valley and also as a student intern for the Alaska Pharmacy Association. As both a former technician in Alaska and a current pharmacist intern, I've seen how these unethical PBM practices have harmed patients in Alaska. While completing a clinical rotation this year, I interacted with a patient who needed a specific medication to treat a blood clot in their leg and was unable to receive it due to the restrictions set by their pharmacy benefits manager. When they attempted to pick up the medication at their local pharmacy, they were informed that they needed to utilize the mail order service and that their medication would not be covered. The patient tried to work with their insurance company and attempted to opt out of the mail order service, but even with that, their copay was over $400. They were not able to afford that copay. The patient returned to the hospital a few days later because their condition had worsened, and later that patient died in the intensive care unit. This death was preventable, and the lives of Alaskans should not be in the hands of pharmacy benefits managers. I've also had a patient cry at my pharmacy pickup counter trying to decide whether or not to purchase their mood stabilizing medication or to prevent readmission to the behavioral health unit or to pay their rent for that month. I've also had countless mothers choose their child's prescription medication over their own, leading to worse health outcomes for the mother. These situations should never be happening. While these are only a few of the examples that I have, I could share dozens of stories if I had the time. In addition to harming Alaskans by restricting their access to life-saving medications, PBMs are contributing to the closure of Alaska's pharmacies. Since this bill was first introduced, another three of Alaska's pharmacies have either closed or announced that they are closing soon. Many pharmacies, both independently owned and chain pharmacies across the state, are suffering from labor shortages and limited hours of operations, which puts up additional barriers to patient care. This is a health crisis, and this needs to be addressed now. Pharmacists are the most accessible healthcare providers in Alaska. Our healthcare infrastructure will crumble without our local pharmacies. Today, I ask the committee to support House Bill 226. This bill will save lives in Alaska, enhance patient safety, and support our local pharmacies to provide access to care. I want to thank each and every one of you for your time and consideration and for recognizing the importance of this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Molina. Any questions? All right. Seeing none, Ms. Hackenmiller, did you want to close us down? Any further questions or comments from committee members, the bill sponsor, or any of our testifiers? All right. Seeing none, we will set this bill aside for further discussion at a later date and get some of these questions that the committee had answered, and we will continue to work on that bill in a future hearing. We will now move on to HB 203, Payment of Wages Payroll Card Account, another bill sponsored by Representative Sumner. Last week we heard an introduction to the bill. Today we are going to hold public testimony on HB 203. So I will now open public testimony. Is there anybody in the room wishing to testify on HB 203? Lots of people standing up, no one coming to the desk. Okay, seeing no one in the room, is there anyone online wishing to testify? There's no one online, going back to the room, going once, going twice. All right, we will close public testimony on HB 203. Okay, we will, I guess, set HB 203 aside for a future hearing where we will consider amendments on payment of wages and payroll card accounts. I will set an amendment deadline on HB 203 for Wednesday morning, March 13th at 11 a.m. Moving on, we are going to take up HB 175. Which is Board of Licensed Midwives. This bill was heard last week. Today we're going to hear public testimony and extending the amendment deadline on HB 175 to tomorrow at 1 p.m. So I will now open public testimony on HB 175. Is there anybody in the room wishing to testify on HB 175? All right, seeing none. Moving online, Looks like we have a couple of folks. First, we will call on Jennifer Cave. Please introduce yourself for the record. We will set testimony time to 2 minutes, and please begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, my name is Jennifer Cave. I'm from Soldotna, Alaska. Can you guys hear me okay?
We can hear you just fine.
Okay. I am a certified direct entry midwife in the state of Alaska, a certified professional midwife nationally, and I currently hold the position of Vice President for the Midwives Association of Alaska. I have been practicing midwifery for about 17 years and have delivered approximately 1,000 babies across 4 countries. I currently own and run the Nesting Place Birth Center in Soldotna, Alaska. I am in favor of HB 175. I myself benefited from midwifery care from multiple midwives in our state. One pregnancy, I had significant postpartum depression, and I had a midwife help me through that very rough time. With the recent change of Medicaid allowing the postpartum period to extend to 1 year after birth, I find it fitting that HB 175 would expand our scope to include the 1 year postpartum period. I have often felt frustrated as a midwife when my clients have had slow healing times or postpartum depression that creeps in a few months after birth, and now they need to establish care with a new provider, sometimes being scheduled months out. This isn't practical for them, nor is it cost effective. It also doesn't help with the load already on our medical system. We have built relationship with our clients over the course of care, and they are turning to us for help, but our hands have been tied. HB 175 would help ease the burden of doctors and help our clients get the care they need in a timely fashion. I also would like to see HB 175 passed, as I personally experienced the frustration of already being a certified professional midwife who had delivered over 300 babies when I applied to license in Alaska. I was told the CPM was not enough for Alaska and I would need to start my studies all over. Thankfully, I was able to license in an acceptable state and then transfer my license to Alaska eventually, but this was a waste of time, money, and resources when I already had my national certification. Lastly, there is one particular insurance company that has found a loophole for reimbursing home births in our state, even though technically, since Medicaid reimburses, they should be as well. This has been extremely frustrating for clients holding that insurance. HB 175 would fix this issue, and they would lose that loophole, which in turn saves the client money. Thank you for your time and for hearing HB 175.
And thank you for your...
How that works.
That, yes, you're right on time. Any questions for Ms. Cave? All right, seeing none, thank you for your testimony. We'll move on to Barbara Norton. Please introduce...
But they're doing 175 right now, but I'm listening to someone testify that it's not happening on television at the same time.
Barbara.
So I think I'm in the queue, but is that, do you know if that's true?
Barbara, you are actually unmuted, ready to testify right now. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
My name is Barbara Norton. I talked to someone earlier.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, Barbara.
But I'm happy to just,
okay,
can you, if,
provide testimony?
Yeah, please, I'll just use this line of
questions
were... I am, okay.
Let's put her on mute, and we'll go to the next person.
Thanks.
Barbara, we're going to put you on mute. It sounds like potentially there's a delay on something, so we're going to come back to you here in just a second. Please just speak to me on the phone where you're at and not listening online. So I'm going to come back to you in just a second, okay? Is there anybody in the room wishing to testify on HB 175? Okay, no one else in room. All right, I am going to come back to you, Barbara. Please have your background noise muted. Talk to me on the phone, and please begin your testimony. Introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for holding a hearing regarding this important issue of public safety. I'm writing today in opposition of House Bill 175. I supported the overriding of Governor Dunleavy's Executive Order 130, disbanding the Board of Direct Entry Midwives, but do not support the statute changes in House Bill 175. Licensed midwives should have their own board to govern the regulations and practice. I was the first nurse midwife in Alaska to collaboratively and cooperatively worked with Direct Entry Midwives in 1995, and I served on their board for 8 years. And during that time, we were able to promote sensible regulation changes to keep Direct Entry Midwife practice up to community standards. But the politicized appointments to the board in the past 2 to 3 years, the two Direct Entry Midwife members completely upended the collaborative practice process and promoted dramatic regulation changes. The board has been in existence since 1992, and for the first 32 years, it functioned very well. Specifically, the changes that are counter to common sense are, number one, removing the doctor and the nurse midwife from the board and replacing them with more direct entry midwives. The CDM community is small, and they are currently unable to address conflicts of interest when a complaint is made against the licensee. Having independent providers on the board has helped with investigations and conflicts in the past. The bill eliminates the requirement for a diploma of any kind. A high school diploma and 18 years of age have been the minimum requirements up to this point. The bill says there can be no regulations requiring collaboration with any hospital, doctor, or advanced nurse practitioner. As a certified nurse midwife, I cannot imagine that I have the education or training to care for every complex client problem without consulting with doctors. And I have a master's in nursing, and I've been practicing for 30 years. The board cannot limit the educational pathways to becoming a direct entry midwife. Any training the board approves, regardless of accreditation or reputation, is okay. The bill removes the requirements that preceptors need not have any experience to train new midwives. The direct entry midwife training is an apprenticeship model, and allowing an inexperienced midwife to train others is not best practice. The House Bill 175 disallows a direct entry midwife to be trained by any doctor or advanced practice nurse. The bill removes language that has for 32 years recommended that women entering prenatal care receive a physical exam by a doctor or a nurse practitioner. This is because direct entry midwife training did not include well women health training. The bill expands the scope of direct entry care to include preconception care, yet direct entry midwives cannot prescribe nor insert any birth control method, nor do they have training in cancer screening, thyroid management, or other common issues that we encounter on a daily basis. They're asking to expand exclusive care of newborns for the first 6 weeks rather than the 4 weeks they are currently allowed. I'm not objecting to 175 because I fear competition, but because the public does not differentiate between types of midwives. And when something tragic happens, all of our practices are adversely affected. In the late 1990s, there was a maternal and newborn death that shook our birthing community. The mother died of an amniotic fluid embolism, which cannot be predicted nor prevented, and the infant died shortly after from asphyxia. The family gave birth in a birthing center less than 2 miles from the hospital. The event received media attention, and all midwives, both CNMs and CDMs, received significant public backlash, and many of our clients requested hospital births for several years just to be safe. The regulation changes would be cemented into practice with House Bill 175. They now allow the highest risk pregnant clients, breech, twins, triplets, previous uterine surgeries, to be cared for in homes with direct entry midwives without a collaborative arrangement with the providers and hospitals that will care for them if something goes wrong. This is a good opportunity for sensible direct entry midwives to get back on their board, add the doctor back, and change the regulations back to pre-2023 to assure the public that the direct entry midwife board has the best interest of the public in mind. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we will move to Deborah Schneider. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you have 2 minutes. Deborah, are you with us? Okay. Deborah, one last chance. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony. Okay, if you can hear me, I cannot hear you. Please, if you do have testimony, you can email it into the committee, please, at house.labor.commerce@akledge.gov. Anyone in the room wishing to testify on HB 175? Seeing none, and I believe we've heard our online testifiers. So I will close public testimony. And again, the amendment deadline for this bill has been extended to tomorrow at 1 p.m. Please get amendments to Mr. Bickford here in the corner before the deadline, and those amendments will be taken up by the committee this week. Now, lastly, we are moving on to HB 254 from Representative Vance. That we did set an amendment deadline for and received zero amendments. It is the wish of the committee to move this bill from committee. Mr. Representative Wright, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Vice Chair Ruffridge. I move House Bill 254, version Bravo, also referred to as 33LS0990S, be advanced from committee with individual recommendations.
Object. For discussion. Can we take a brief at ease?
Brief at ease. All right, back on record, and there is an objection. Representative Garrick.
Thank you to the chair. I'm going to maintain my objection.
Thank you, Representative Garrick. Would you care to speak to your objection?
I believe this bill has some implications beyond the positive intent that the sponsor has, and we talked a little bit about that. We heard a significant amount of testimony speaking to the intent of the bill, and again, I agree with the intent of the bill, but I believe the bill has some loopholes or some gaps that could lead to some poor outcomes, so I'm going to oppose the bill.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Representative Fields?
Yeah, I think the concept of the bill is a good one, but we haven't really heard from anyone other than the bill sponsor and a few citizens about the general merits of the bill. We haven't actually talked through how the bill would work in the real world, and I don't have a lot of confidence that kind of vetting is going to be done in the next committee, so I don't support moving it on at this time. If we're going to do it, we should do it right.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Did you have any questions for the bill sponsor? We have Mr. Ballinger here at the moment.
No, I think if we were going to move this, we would want to hear from some people with greater expertise in the digital economy to make sure that we're designing it right. That would be what I would suggest.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Representative Sadler, did you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would be wanting to move it along, but I will echo some of the comments. I'd like to know a little bit more. You know, there's talk. I don't know much about commercially available age verification. I know that there's federal regulation of internet communications. It's a broad area. I support the underlying effort of the bill, but I'm hoping that if we don't do it, that there is more fleshing out of how the bill's intent would be carried out, again, in the real world, practically speaking. The internet is a varied place and can be a problematic place. There's lots of different forces that work on it, and I don't feel that I've got full understanding of the implications. But I won't stand in the way the bill's advanced. Huh?
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Carrick?
I just wanted to note through the chair that I had asked on the record what some of the commercially available options for verification were. What are some of the private companies that exist that are potentially doing this? And to the sponsor's office credit, they did provide after the hearing. They didn't have it on hand at the time, but after the hearing, a list of some potential options. But when I looked further into the top five or six of those, I think 10 to 13 or so that were listed, there were some potential security issues that I could foresee with Alaskans and their identification. And again, the broad implications of this bill are not fully vetted or understood. And so there could definitely be scenarios where Alaskans are uploading their identification in order to access a large number of sites, not just those that are the sponsor's intent. So.
Okay, thank you. Any further discussion? No. Okay, we will call the roll. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Wright.
Yes.
Representative Carrick.
No.
Representative Fields.
No.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yes.
4 yeas, 2 nays.
All right. With a vote of 4 yeas and 2 nays, House Bill 254 has passed from committee. Seeing that there is no other business before us today, I will adjourn the committee, but please make sure that you maintain your attendance to sign the paperwork for House Bill 254. Let the record reflect that the time is 5:02 p.m. and we are adjourned.